I think the win was expected. The question was, what would the margin of victory be, and would it be higher or lower than the last time?
We will tell you what we know about India's election. This is VOA Asia on Friday, May 24th. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, on the day India found out about its election, Pakistan test launched a missile. The United States shells out billions of dollars to its farmers. All of that and more on today's VOA Asia. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi promised to build a strong and inclusive country as the charismatic but polarizing leader swept back to power in the world's largest democracy with an even bigger mandate than he won 5 years ago. The Prime Minister tweeted, "Thank you, India. The faith placed in our alliance is humbling and gives us strength to work even harder to fulfill people's aspirations." His Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, is on course to win about 300 seats according to the vote count so far. That puts the BJP well past the halfway mark in Parliament and would make it the first political party in 35 years to secure a majority twice in a row. Along with its coalition partners, it will have a commanding majority in Parliament, which has 543 elected seats. We welcome to VOA Asia via Skype Susan Osterman, Assistant Professor of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame and an expert in comparative politics in South Asia. Susan, is this, especially the apparent margin of victory, a surprise?
I think the win was expected. The question was, what would the margin of victory be, and would it be higher or lower than the last time? And the polls were not clear. So it looks to be higher than many people were expecting. The last time Narendra Modi swept to victory, a pretty resounding victory, he didn't have even 50% of the popular vote. So I'll be curious to look at the data later on to see how resounding this victory is.
Mr. Modi has been described as being polarizing. Can you explain that?
So I think even Mr. Modi would agree that he has had a polarizing effect. In part, he's polarizing because of his history. When he was chief minister of the state of Gujarat, he was present at a time, he has not been implicated in the events, but he was present at a time when Hindu riots or Hindu-Muslim riots, communal riots took place. And several members of his administration were implicated in that particular incident. He's also pushed an agenda of Hindu nationalist politics in a place that is incredibly diverse. The largest minority in India is a Muslim minority. And part of his politics is seen, at least on the ground, as being anti-Muslim. So that is what a lot of people understand his divisive politics to be.
So what do you expect him to do, if anything, to try to heal that wound?
Well, the interesting thing is, and I'm going to take you back in history to 2014, when a number of us were truly worried about his ascension to power and what that might look like on the ground in terms of real people's lives, life and death, right? I was surprised in 2014 to see the degree to which he fairly specifically adopted a more moderate stance than he had when he was chief minister of Gujarat in public, and made a number of overtures to Pakistan as well as to the Muslim minority in India. There have been a number of high-profile incidents involving communal violence or divisive politics. At this point, we don't know for sure what the vote count will be, but it does look like he will secure more votes than he did last time, or at least more seats in the Lok Sabha. So he may feel emboldened by that victory, as well as a number of other incidents in the recent past.
What else do you think might change, or do you think it's pretty much going to be a continuation of what we have been seeing with him in office?
The one thing I hope will change, and that I think many Indians hope will change, is the economy. India, of course, is growing at incredibly high rates of growth by developed country standards, but the growth has not been as robust as many people hoped it would be. It's also not trickled down to as much of the population as one would hope in a developing democracy where a large majority of the population remains poor. In fact, inequality has increased during Narendra Modi's tenure so far, and I think the vast majority of Indians are probably sitting there hoping that that will change. There's an incredible amount of wealth, as in the US and a number of other countries, that has been consolidated amongst the top 10% and even the top 1% of the Indian population. That is where the dividends of growth have gone. The average person, especially in rural India, has not seen much progress.
Susan Osterman is an assistant professor of global affairs at the University of Notre Dame. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
We invite you to read more on this top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories you can find right now at voanews.com. An American man convicted of providing support to the Taliban has been released from prison. John Walker Lynn, known as the American Taliban, was released after serving 17 years of a 20-year sentence. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has accused the head of Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei Technologies of lying about his company's relationship with the government in Beijing. The United Nations warned Thursday the civilian casualty toll from airstrikes by pro-government forces in Afghanistan continues to rise. Calm returned to the streets of Jakarta Thursday after clashes between police and supporters of the losing candidate in Indonesia's presidential election. You're listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues now. An Indian defense expert says Pakistan was sending contradictory signals after it conducted a missile test Thursday as Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan congratulated India's Narendra Modi for his election victory. Khan congratulated Modi for a triumphant victory that returned him to power in New Delhi after an election fought in the shadow of renewed confrontation between the nuclear-armed enemies. But in a possible warning to India, Pakistan earlier announced that it had conducted a training launch of a Shaheen 2 surface-to-surface ballistic missile, which it said is capable of delivering conventional and nuclear weapons at a range of up to 1,500 miles. Khan's message follows months of tension between the two countries, which came close to war in February over the disputed region of Kashmir, which both sides have claimed since independence from Britain in 1947. Joining us is Michael Kugelman. He is senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Michael, thanks for being with us. Why do you think Pakistan chose this day to show off a new missile?
Well, I think it was meant to coincide with the Indian election results. There was an expectation in Pakistan, as elsewhere, that Narendra Modi was going to be reelected. So I do not think it's a coincidence that this missile was tested at the very moment when Narendra Modi, a hardliner on Pakistan and the member of a political party that takes a hard line on Pakistan, was reelected. So I think in some ways this missile test was meant to be a strange form of congratulations to Modi. And really, it was meant to project strength and resolve. And I think it was meant to suggest to India that, Pakistan is not going to be taken lightly, that it has the capacity to project military power and military strength, keeping in mind that it was not too long ago when India and Pakistan almost went to war. So the emotions are still raw over that crisis between India and Pakistan several months back.
But doesn't this make an already hard line, Narendra Modi, even harder with something like this?
I mean, to be honest, I don't think that he's going to pay all that much attention to this test. I mean, of course, he's basking in the glory of his election victory right now, and that's what he was doing when the test was done. You know, Pakistan has done a number of these tests in previous months and years. India's done the same. So I don't really think it's going to have much of an impact on Modi's thinking about Pakistan. I mean, if you look at the situation, when Modi first took office in 2014, when he was elected the first time, he actually extended an olive branch to Pakistan. He invited Nawaz Sharif, at the time the Prime Minister of Pakistan, to his inauguration. And it was some time after that when the relationship went downhill. But things are in a very different position now than they were back in 2014. Again, you have the fact that only recently India and Pakistan almost went to war. So, regardless of whether this missile test had taken place or not, Modi was going to take a hard line on Pakistan. His party has made it quite clear, and they made it quite clear on the campaign trail that they're not in the mood to talk with Pakistan. They're not in the mood to launch a dialogue anytime soon. So that's quite clear. There's some pretty strong, emphatic thinking there on the part of Modi and his party. And so in that sense, this missile test was immaterial. It wasn't going to change the calculus.
Where do you put this dispute, and it's a long time running, as you mentioned, between India and Pakistan on the list of hotspots around the world?
I mean, I'd put it up at the top of the list. I mean, certainly, these days we have to talk about North Korea, we have to talk about Iran, but I put India and Pakistan up at the top of the list just because, this is a case of two bitter rivals who both have nuclear weapons and have fought multiple wars against each other. That does not, there's no equivalent of that anywhere else in the world. And the fact that just a few months ago, India and Pakistan exchanged airstrikes, and they demonstrated that they're perfectly comfortable using force against each other, even under the nuclear umbrella. For a long time, there had been a view that the fact that both countries had nuclear weapons would serve as a deterrent and make it unlikely that both countries would fight a hot war. And yet, they both launched airstrikes on each other's soil a few months ago for the first time since 1971. So for all those reasons, I think we really need to be very concerned about the volatility of this relationship and the prospects for another war.
Michael Kugelman joined us via Skype. As always, thank you, Michael. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Here's what's happening now in Asia. The Senate Armed Services Committee unveiled a draft bill Thursday that targets China on several fronts, from stemming the erosion of the U.S. military advantage against Beijing to countering the growing Chinese influence around the world. The committee acknowledged that our margin of military supremacy has eroded and is undermined by new threats from strategic competitors like China and Russia. Stay up to date with VOA. We're happy you're with us. President Donald Trump rolled out billions of dollars in aid for farmers hurt by his trade policies Thursday, and financial markets shook Thursday on the growing realization that the U.S. and China are far from settling a bitter year-long trade dispute.
So today I'm announcing that I have directed Secretary Perdue to provide $16 billion in assistance to America's farmers and ranchers. It all comes from China. We'll be taking in, over a period of time, hundreds of billions of dollars in tariffs and charges to China. And our farmers will be greatly helped. We want to get them back to the point where they would have had if they had a good year. This support for farmers will be paid for by the billions of dollars our Treasury takes in. We'll be taking in, depending on what period of time we're talking, many billions of dollars, far more than the $16 billion that we're talking about. But the $16 billion in funds will help keep our cherished farms thriving and make clear that no country has veto on America's economic and national security.
U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue said that the first of three payments is likely to be made in July or August, and suggested that the U.S. and China were unlikely to have settled their differences by then. The latest bailout comes atop $11 billion in aid Trump provided farmers last year. U.S. crude oil plunged 6% on fears that the trade standoff could knock the global economy out of kilter and kill demand for energy. Talks between the world's two biggest economies broke off earlier this month with no resolution to a dispute over Beijing's aggressive efforts to challenge American technological dominance. The U.S. charges that China is stealing technology, unfairly subsidizing its own companies, and forcing U.S. companies to hand over trade secrets if they want access to the Chinese market. Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping are expected to discuss the standoff at a meeting of the group of 20 major economies in Osaka, Japan next month. There are no current plans for talks to occur before then. Now, the payments will go to farmers producing roughly two dozen crops, including soybeans, corn, canola, peanuts, cotton, and wheat. Dairy and hog farmers are also eligible. U.S. soybean exports to China have been hit particularly hard, falling from $12.3 billion in 2017 to just $3.2 billion last year. The aid offsets some of the losses, but farmers are worried about the future and whether they can win back lost sales in China, a market they have spent years breaking into. Coming up, some Thailand marijuana users are confused. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Brunei's Sultan Hassanala Bolkiah has returned an honorary degree awarded by Britain's Oxford University after a global backlash led by celebrities including George Clooney and Elton John for proposing the death penalty for gay sex and adultery. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. The legalization of marijuana for medical use in Thailand has created confusion over who can produce it and what qualifies consumers to legally use it. The National Assembly approved the legislation late last year, but the regulations governing the new law have yet to be put in place. Steve Sanford spoke to independent producers of cannabis oil, as well as consumers affected by the new law, as the government's deadline for users to register drew to a close this past week.
Across Thailand, thousands of users registered in accordance with the nation's new and still unclear medical marijuana law. Health officials who have taken brief courses about medical cannabis welcome those registering.
Right now, we are in a period of transition regarding government laws. They can use the documents to allow possession of marijuana for now until the government passes a final law. When that law is passed, patients using cannabis will have to consult with a doctor provided by the government.
Critics say big corporations will benefit from legalization because state-issued permits are needed to grow the plants. And Thai rights activists like Akradag Jakjinda are concerned that recreational use is still a criminal offense.
The biggest concern of the people is that the police will try to arrest them in their home because they have information. Right now, we've gotten assurance that if the authorities try to arrest us, the legal amnesty will protect us because we have already identified ourselves and told them how much we have.
For many who privately produce cannabis oil to treat family and friends for ailments like pain and depression, the benefits outweigh the risks. And while the ingredients and production are less than perfect, users claim that the home-produced remedies are working.
I'm trying to learn more because my father had cancer, and there is no other way. I don't want my dad to have to take chemical treatment or something like that. So I found a way to use cannabis oil, processed from marijuana, to treat him.
With the country still in the midst of finalizing the regulations governing medical marijuana, Thais will be watching to see who will truly benefit from this new law. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Krabi, Thailand.
This news alert from VOA Asia, two U.S. warships have sailed through the Taiwan Strait in an apparent show of support for the government of the self-ruled island, which China claims as its own. Taiwan's defense ministry said in a statement the ships passed through the south to north on Wednesday without incident, adding they were free to sail in the Taiwan Strait. China, which last month complained about a friendship's passage through the strait, said it had expressed concern to the U.S. side. You're listening to VOA Asia. A Belgian abbey is working to revive its centuries-old tradition of beer making after a break of 220 years. The monks at the Grimbergen Abbey are looking into ancient recipes to offer specialty beers in their new microbrewery. Meanwhile, researchers in Israel have made beer with yeast extracted from thousands of year-old jars found in archaeological digs. Beer is one of the oldest and most popular beverages in the world, and producers are vying for customers with new and attractive brews. But as VOA's Lata Chahok reports, there is a growing interest in traditional beers and the history of brewing.
Beer connoisseurs' perpetual quest for new and interesting brews has sparked a global trend of microbreweries offering their own specialty beers. Monks at Grimbergen Abbey in Belgium have looked into their own beer-making past and decided to revive the order's brewing heritage.
Brewing and religion life was always come together. And when we have now the opportunity to also give, and with the support of Alkemaas and the support of Carlsberg, you don't must wait from that. And so that was the start of a dream to bring back the Grimbergen in a little part here in the microbrewery.
The monks are combining old recipes detailed in books, some dating back to the 12th century, with modern techniques to craft limited edition batches.
So what will be special about the beer? We will keep our Grimbergen DNA, which is a yeast, and we will also use some local ingredients. For example, we are start to grow hops in the garden of the abbey. So we are thinking about limited batch that will bring some hops from the garden, and also working with local farmers and local actors here in Grimbergen.
The Grimbergen microbrewery will open to the public in late 2020 and is projected to produce about 10,000 hectoliters of beer at the abbey. Larger quantities will be produced in other countries. The interest in ancient brewing methods doesn't stop there. Israeli researchers say they have extracted yeast from the remains of jars found at archaeological sites and have used them to concoct a brew similar to the kind imbibed by pharaohs thousands of years ago.
We know that they used wheat, they used yeast, they used water, and they didn't have any preservators like today for the beer. Now, what they added, there were some flavoring material, like date concentration and things like this, maybe honey.
On Wednesday, researchers from Jerusalem's Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University presented a beer brewed with yeast descended from a 3,000-year-old jar. They plan to combine ancient recipes with modern methods to brew beer that could one day be produced commercially. Zlatica Hope, VOA News, Washington.
Looking for ways to hit back at Washington as a tariff fight escalates, President Xi Jinping and his economy czar visited a Chinese factory that processes rare earths, exotic minerals used in electric cars, mobile phones, and other technology. Rare earths are an important strategic resource, the official Xinhua news agency cited Xi as saying. The message was clear. China's role as the main global supplier of rare earths used in smartphones, lightweight magnets, batteries, and other components is leverage over Washington. And China's sway could extend much further into the U.S. technology sector, particularly to Apple and other companies that rely on Chinese manufacturing.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists from the University of Texas, Austin, and the University of Arizona in Tucson say they have found the remains of ancient ice sheets buried in layers 1.6 kilometers beneath the northern polar cap of Mars. Using data gathered by the Shallow Radar Instrument on NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the researchers found that each layer of polar ice was topped with a coating of wind-blown sand as the planet warmed. Writing in the journal Geophysical Research Letters, the scientists say the layers of ancient ice and sand, like layers on a cake, provides a record of the red planet's past climate. The growth and melting of the Martian polar ice cap is thought to reflect changes in the planet's orbit and tilt over the years. The scientists say that if the newly found ice were melted, it would cover Mars with water at least 1.5 meters deep. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com. Our thanks to you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, our managing editor, Diane Gow, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Enjoy your day.